The Arctic National Wildlife Refuge is on the north slope of Alaska, the corner closest to Canada. And it's the only part set aside as wilderness. It's the only part of the whole north slope where you cannot explore or drill for oil. And I asked if this wasn't greed, this whole situation, that we needed to get in there. Just this one small place has been set aside, and yet we need to get in there too. And we talked about that a lot, and quite a few people seemed to feel that it was greed of the oil company, the businessman, was one of the reasons that we wanted to get in there. But someone else brought up that weren't we just making the oil companies out to be the bad guys? Because all they were doing was trying to supply our need. Now, most of y'all, well, probably everyone here, remembers when the OPEC nations came together and started setting a limit, and all of a sudden, we had lines at the gas stations for the first time. Does everyone remember that? Mm-hmm. And then you remember that immediately we started, our government and the businesses started responding. All of a sudden we had cars that got better gas mileage. We had laws about what kind of gas mileage cars should have. And then you started hearing all kinds of things about conserving energy in our homes, and started talking about insulation, things like that. And the government subsidized a lot of studies into energy and started reimbursing people for making their homes more, and office buildings more energy efficient. And all kinds of things started happening. And our oil imports cut back. But in 1980, we had a different president, different policy. And everything was relaxed, and it was no longer funding into renewable resources, energy resources, and such. And we seemed to forget that it was ever a problem, because prices and gas went down, and surely there was a good available supply. Now we find ourselves in another crisis. The scientists are telling us that about global warming. Global warming is something new. We only first started hearing about it a couple of years ago. I can find materials back in the library back to 86. Does everyone think they understand what global warming is? Do you know the difference between global warming and ozone depletion? Does everyone understand that those are two different situations?
And they're not connected?
They're connected in that the gases that lead to ozone depletion can be global warming gases that contribute to that. But it's two different situations. excuse me, real briefly, we release things into the atmosphere, mainly chloride gases that come from products like Freon that we use in our automobile and home air conditioners. And we use certain cleaners to clean computers and things like that. But it's mainly from our refrigerators and our air conditioning. That's Freon mainly. There are other things. But when it takes them 15 years to travel up to the ozone, which is the highest level of our atmosphere. Our atmosphere has something like five different levels. And the ozone is that top layer which helps deflect certain harmful UV rays of the sun. Well, when these chloride gases get up there, they alter the O3, the ozone molecules, and change them, I think, into O2. But one molecule of this chloride gas can change billions of ozone particles. So what this is doing, everyone's heard that there's a hole at Antarctica. There's a hole in the ozone layer. Can anyone tell me how big that hole is? It's an ever-changing thing, and it's bigger at one time of the year than in others. But it's and when it's at its largest, it's the size of North America.
Is this located on poles?
Antarctica.
Why is it located down there?
It has to do with the circulation of the air, and that's why it's larger at one time of the year than the other. It has to do with the seasons and the changes and the way the prevailing winds.
When was this first discovered?
Well, it was first discovered just, about 3 years ago or so. And it's real interesting that the computers didn't pick up on it, because when it happened so radically that the computer was programmed to screen out really large deviations, because that would just be some sort of malfunction. And so it didn't pick up on it, because it was there. So,
is that the only one?
Well, there's ozone depletion around the planet, and there seems to be maybe a little bit at the other pole, but the only one that is large and that we're concerned with and we're studying in particular, and that's one that we concentrate on in all the information, in the south over Antarctica. Okay, now, one of the Race to Save the Planet video series starts off with a plastic surgeon in Australia talking about his business is booming, that melanoma, skin cancer rate in Australia is growing at like 300% a year. And I think that if this was happening to us, we'd be a lot more concerned about this. As right. it is happening. Melanoma cancer is up something like 25% or so in this country.
But it's very fashionable to get tans. I was wondering how much that plays into this. If they sit in the sun all day long, I mean, then what happens?
But I understand that, like in New York, which is a fashion center, it's very fashionable this year to be pale. I understand that's the height of fashion now, is to be pale. We're a little behind that, you know. We don't understand, and we still work on our tan.
But then you're saying, yeah, why buy less and all these things, then we'll help the situation.
Mm-hmm.
Ethics and lifestyle.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll get into that.
Lifestyle.
About what our purchases and how we act is a direct influence on helping this situation in both global warming and ozone depletion. Okay, now that was ozone depletion, and now what global warming is maybe a much more serious problem. With the loss of ozone, now this could turn out to be very serious. We had a scientist here last year, and he was explaining that this is so far-reaching. It would be amazing if we lose the ozone, if the ozone is depleted further to the point to where it affects, he said one thing, just one thing would be it could affect the eyesight of bees. And if bees couldn't fly from plant to plant and they couldn't pollinate, we would start losing all plant life. I mean, so many things that you could think of. Their germination depends on bees for pollination, more than just flowers. Flowers and trees, surely, but many, many things. And just a couple things, you know, I don't need another example, just there. That would be astounding that we did it, and it's directly to our lifestyle. The number one cause of ozone depletion is Freon and CFCs. Now we're working on CFCs. Everyone's, you know, is no longer using styrofoam cups in their churches and everything. But are you willing to give up air conditioning?
But doesn't it happen when it's destroyed?
Hmm?
It doesn't. If the air conditioner is working properly, nothing is given off. Is it? It's just when they destroy, take tools.
When they leak.
And they pop the tube and goes up there, mm-hmm. and destructive.
But they leak. They leak.
And old ones are thrown away.
And they have to be produced with Freon in them.
Mm-hmm. the CFC, you know, if you're having a big manufacturing plant and they're producing freon, you know that there's going to be stuff released in the production of it.
And that means you're going after big business then?
Well, we should, it's all these things are top down and bottom up. And so for the top down things, you know, you can be writing letters, you know, to your Congress people. Our country is the only one that was, the industrial nations got together, the Montreal Accord, I think in 87, and another one last year. And all the industrial nations were there, and they all signed on except for the United States. And there was another that talked about global warming, and everyone was willing to set limits, like they set limits
they all signed
on production. The Accord to where they would set limits on
mm-hmm.
production and,
mm-hmm.
and what the percentage less mm-hmm. each year.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And our official, our government policy on global warming is that we don't know yet. The numbers aren't in. And we don't know that this is going to happen. But at the time they did that, there had been 18 major scientific studies, and 17 of them agreed that there was global warming.
But you're saying that ozone depletion is not the cause of global warming.
Right.
What's the cause of global warming?
Global warming is, okay, now the cause of ozone depletion is us introducing things into the atmosphere, things that weren't there, things that are humanly made, and that alter, okay? Global warming is the same thing in that things are introduced to the atmosphere. But global warming is mainly, well, there's several different gases, but if we just dealt with, talked about carbon dioxide and methane, those are two big global warming. They contribute mainly to the problem. Also, you know, CFCs and things are also considered greenhouse gases, but that's a small percentage. The majority of it is carbon dioxide from our cars and from our coal-fired heating plants, coal-fired electricity producing plants.
And when they started that, they sort of thought it was going to help. No, they thought coal burning was another method of conserving or making enough electricity for us. And all at once in Oregon, it's just, you know, they've made it too airtight and all this, and people are suffering from it.
Mm. Well, yeah, most of the, there's a lot of places in the country that have inversions. They're low-lying areas and valleys, mm-hmm. and what happens is smoke rises, and it reaches a certain level, and then comes right back down. It's amazing when sometimes you'll be driving past a house where there obviously you have a fire going, mm-hmm. and you'll see the smoke going up just to maybe 20 feet and then coming down and surrounding the house. And here in Holden Village, we have that situation where the smoke doesn't just rise up and go on, it hangs around.
And pesticides and these other things, that's not connected
to global warming. Global warming. Now,
aren't also natural things like mousing elements.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to never know the answer to that. More volcanic eruptions that can cause havoc with the upper atmosphere for more than a year.
Yeah, I mean, we know it did some, but we know that Mount St. Helens is nothing compared to the eruption of Krakatoa 100 years ago. You can go back and look at temperatures, and temperatures changed by a couple degrees. Now, there's a book about global warming that came out about 2 years ago that's really good, very readable and enjoyable, called The End of Nature by William McKibben. And that's good in that One of the things that he states is that nature, as we know it, as we've always thought of nature, has ended. And what we have from now on is a humanly altered ecosystem. That we have been introducing things to such a degree that we have changed it. I read this a long time ago, but he was talking about you can go take cores at the Arctic, ice cores, and you can go back and you can see when the Industrial Revolution began. When in the late 1700s, all of a sudden you start seeing these particles, and you see it just building up. Now,
What about diesel fuel?
All fossil fuels, when they're burnt, release carbon dioxide. And that's real simple. That when plants grow, they take in oxygen and store carbon. So when plants decompose, they release carbon. So even a tree, when a tree falls and starts decomposing, it's releasing some carbon into the atmosphere. But it's a lot larger problem when it's burned and when a lot is burned at the same time. So in states like Oregon and Washington, where you have a lot of wood-burning fireplaces in the northeast of the United States, when the energy crunch came in the mid-70s and a lot of people got wood-burning stoves and started burning, all of a sudden, pollution in some communities was a lot worse. So when you start making choices, you have to think them out carefully. I don't want anyone to get the impression that there's no right choices. There's right choices for every situation. But in some places, because you want to save, it's good to burn wood because wood is a renewable energy source. But it's bad to burn wood when it adds to the pollution of your community. And basically any wood that's burned, whether it's in a small community in Oregon or the wilderness up here or the Northeast, a very populated place like the Northeast, that is still smoke that is carbon that is introduced into the atmosphere that adds to the global. It doesn't matter where that fire on the planet burns, it still affects all of us.
Is air travel a very big factor? Is that...
You mean how it's distributed?
Air
travel, if you fly? Oh, yeah. I heard a speaker in Chicago, and he was from California. It was a man that wrote this book on Ecotopia, a fictional book, about 15 years ago. And he talked about Northern California, Oregon, and Washington breaking off from the rest of the country because our values were different and because we had this beautiful ecosystem that we wanted to preserve and that we acted to preserve it. And that it became a sort of an ideal environmentalist utopia, ecotopia. But he spoke, and he felt really bad that he flew out there because the amount of jet fuel that is burned by jets is incredible. The very best way to travel long distances would be, besides walking and horse, would be to take the train. If everyone, when they come back to Holton, takes the train, it would be a wonderful thing, and I wish that we would put that on our information. Urge people that can easily take the train to take the train. You get here basically quicker, safer, but you don't have the freedom to stop wherever you want to. I want to get into about why are we addicted to our automobiles. I think one of the reasons is freedom, the sense of freedom, and the sense of security. But in the long run, how much freedom and security is it if we're killing ourselves? That's the question I asked yesterday. We had talked about automobiles for a little while, and I said, well, would it be safe to say that our automobiles are killing us? And
is progress killing us? You know?
Is it?
This is what it's all about. We get better and better and better, mm-hmm. And space program has brought about things that, you know, make things easier.
Mm-hmm.
It's progress. We have to go on, go back to the Native American way of life then, mm-hmm. and maintain this type of forest if you want to.
And well, let's talk about that for a minute.
You know, a simple way of living, fine, wonderful.
Well, then I'm okay.
Can you pay your insurance on that? Can you pay your medical insurance and health insurance? We have fixed things that before we can get out of bed that we have to pay that doesn't, you know, mm-hmm. that if I went back to the Native American top, fine, I could do that, live up there, just beautiful. Mm-hmm. Others can't personally afford that.
Mm-hmm.
But we're talking about lifestyle changes.
Right.
That's the one. For this ecology, what you're talking mm-hmm. about.
And I would propose that there is no going back. Mm-hmm. That instead we're going to have to envision an alternative future, given the feel that we're now working in a global economy, and still looking at the development of healthcare and education and employment systems for people in the third world as well as in the first world. That in fact the changes in our personal lifestyles are pretty insignificant in terms of changing. Having any impact at all on global warming or whatever. We may act as symbols, personal symbols in our community, but the communities as a whole are not going to go this direction. So what's disappointed me about the ecological movement, while it provides some education, it doesn't envision a future for the world. I don't know where to look for that.
Well, I think it does.
I think it envisions a past. It envisions a going back to a lifestyle that is not feasible in the 21st century.
I can sometimes vision, wouldn't it be great if our newspapers here in this country would put this little B story you have for us, mm-hmm. big heavy letters there. That doesn't happen. We have all these other things in the paper all the time.
Well, I think the things are there, but it's we have information overload. You know, any major city newspaper with, especially like a Wednesday, Thursday, or a Sunday edition, you know, 200 pages, how many words per page, you know, we're assaulted with so much stuff.
Look what's happening in South America, into the Amazon Basin. Native people, of course, are burning
yeah.
the Amazon Basin,
yeah.
which we were doing when we settled this country. We were clearing land and cutting and burning. For us to get ahead, and yet down there now, so they can't do that because they're trying to get ahead.
That's a really,
you know, this
really good example of environmental ethics, and mm-hmm. It's very complicated because one thing that you're immediately into is the northern hemisphere, the first world, telling southern hemisphere, the third world, what to do. And a couple of years ago, a conference of scientists in Brazil issued a statement telling the other scientists in the world to back off. They said, and they were specifically talking to American scientists, and said, 100 years ago, you committed genocide. And you're going to come and tell us about cutting down some trees? That's what you did to get your land, mm-hmm. you know, and then it's further complicated because now what they're doing is they're slashing and burning forest at a greater degree. Two of the reasons are because of population, that they need the land, they need the food, and because of food exports. Okay. They're cutting it down, and we affect both of those. Okay, it's our need for cheap beef, for fast food hamburgers, that they want to cut down forest to turn it into land for grazing cattle. And we buy that cheap beef. Okay, and then the other reason is that scientists know that. One of the reasons overpopulation results is in poorer countries is because that is the only security families have. The children die at a higher rate, and they have no social security systems. Inflation is rampant. If you have a lot of children, And that's the most security, that someone's going to, that you're going to have a better chance of survival in your later years. We know that when you study, when countries, when the economic situation improves, the birth rate drops. Okay, why is the, do they have this rampant inflation in South America? Why are things so bad for economically? They're working to pay off global debt, their third world debt you hear about. Brazil owns a staggering amount of money to the World Bank. And basically the World Bank is the industrialized nations, but it's mainly American and well, other European people. But basically the U.S. has a big, has a lot to say to what the World Bank does.
I think we're as dark, you know, I firmly believe I can do something about her and that I have a defect in this. But in our education program, we have to stop and say to each one of us, you have to pick a point where you're going to begin. And we have to struggle with that before we can try to educate all these other people around us. If I'm an example, we do that. We've been recycling since 1968.
Great.
I feel that way too. I feel that we can't blame the motor companies, the oil companies. I think it's individual greed that makes up the corporate greed.
Mm-hmm. But it doesn't have to be just a matter of personal choices, that there can be policy changes made. But for example, so many things that we buy are shipped across the country that we wouldn't necessarily have to be transported across the country. I mean, why should we buy oranges from Florida when we get them from California?
But what I'm saying is you have to start with yourself where you can start telling other people what to do.
It's a place to start.
And if you aren't an example, you have no right, just like you're saying in South America, to tell people to change their life.
Can't you do both? And I mean, can't you both practice and tell other people, and more importantly, okay, by your practicing, then you have experience that's valid, and you know what you can, you know, tell and what's helpful, and also you are then a living example, and your neighbors, your relatives, and all. They know that you are practicing, and people will come to you, you know, and ask you questions. I mean, if you've been recycling from 68, I'm sure you probably have some neighbors that are starting to recycle now, and they're asking you questions.
It didn't happen. And my greatest struggle has been in our family to share with you what has happened. We've had, we quit buying all these Christmas gifts because I tell my children, we're having Christmas every day of the year. You have all the clothes you need. But we are excluded from our family Christmas celebration because I said, this is ridiculous. There are four children, we're all married, we have families, so there were 25 of us, and now nieces and nephews are getting married. We're exchanging names, and I said, I refuse to do that. I have become an outcast in my family because of my lifestyle, to a degree.
Mm-hmm.
I refuse to come home and celebrate Christmas that way. And that's the only way they want to be. The rest have not changed to what we want to do. And that's the struggle we're going to have in our society more than being able to do this. It's easy to recycle,
mm-hmm.
but if you have no one doing it with you, pretty soon you think, I must be the wrong one, you know? And people shy from you. It's not easy to recycle. We were 100 students in the Bethel series when the recycling came. I was selected in my congregation. I went to couples clubs, I went to churches, I spoke from the pulpit, I spoke at the pastor's conferences. And we said at the Bethel series to 100 people, we have a garage, if you put your newspapers and tin cans and glass bottles, you bring them to us, we will haul them 35 miles to Mankato. Do you want to guess how many people took into the system? Zero.
Mm-hmm.
A Methodist friend, many years later, we were raising children at the same time and walking them, and we talked about this recycling. And they had been Peace Corps workers mm-hmm. in Korea, so they knew what I was talking about lifestyle. She decided to do it with her family. We were the only two in a city of 3,000 people. Mm-hmm. And we moved to 78, and we started in 68, and we were the only two families mm-hmm. that did that. We moved across the state to Minnesota. And I'm recycling like mad. There was no area. We hauled it all the way to Fairmont, 200 miles from where we lived, on our way to visit the in-laws. Our trunk was full with recycled items. I'm the only one who did it. And I dry my clothes in the basement clothesline. I don't dare tell too many people because I am weird. I'm serious. You know, I'm just the weird one. And I've been trying, and I walk wherever I go. You're in the street, Phyllis. What are you doing out here in 20 below weather? It didn't, you know, it just didn't rub off, but pretty soon more people were walking, but it took 10, 15 years. See what I'm saying? I have firmly believed within myself that I'm going to live like that, and I'm not going to be popular all the time, but that is hard for other people to grasp all the time. I'm kind of weird in my family.
Wasn't that kind of the lifestyle of people though in the 20s and 30s and 40s and during the Depression years when they had kind of a hard time? And of course in the war enforced certain type of things where they did save tin cans and all these kind of things. And
Greece.
They were doing these type of things and it was such a struggle for them. But then they come to the next flip-flop generation, and that generation says, these kids aren't going to have to do what we do. Yeah. They're not going to suffer like we suffered. So then we've got the flip-flop of luxury. And we're just sort of, in my book, I look back at my parents, it's just like going back to what it was. And there you hear these stories, supposedly horror stories, of what they had to do back then. We're doing exactly what they were doing back in those days. They saved every little thing, a piece of string, this long is shaved so they had more string. I mean, and some of the things was coming with, they were supposed to save these for the war effort, and then they found out they were completely wasted, thrown in the ocean or something. So that was the worst part.
And why is recycled stuff more expensive than building from scratch? Recycled newspapers, they cost more than buying from the factories.
Well, newspapers right now are really hard to get rid of. Nobody wants them.
There are money and greed.
And in California, aluminum cans are coming to an end.
There's a couple of things that contribute to that. I know a little bit about newspapers and a little bit I just learned from a guy who was here last week about steel. Apparently, the reason aluminum is recycled more than steel in this country is because the steel, the iron mining industry is subsidized to the point where it's cheaper to dig this stuff out of the strip mine than it is to recycle what you've already got smelted. And I think my personal figuring is that probably the reason aluminum is easier to recycle is because we import bauxite, aluminum ore, from places like Jamaica and Africa, and also from South America. And if, theoretically, if we had bauxite mines in this country, maybe it wouldn't be economical to recycle that. And with newspapers and a lot of paper, I know, and similarly with glass, I think, there's big piles of green glass somewhere in Oregon where they are. But with newspapers, and with recycled paper at this point, there's a couple of factors. The first is that I think you were talking the other day about there aren't any factories that recycle newspaper. And
there's
very, very few. And what happens is because there aren't too many factories, the reason there aren't many factories is because previously there wasn't much demand, so they couldn't make money if they recycle. Now there are a few factories and there's a lot of demand, so the price is still high because there isn't a whole lot of recycled newspaper out there now. But and because, if you've got one factory but it's in Southern Oregon or something, it costs a lot for somebody to take all that stuff all the way from Washington. And if they've only got one factory, they can't recycle everything from everywhere. So it probably is still very difficult. Then you were saying the other day, or somebody was commenting on how there's a brand new paper mill in the Columbia River somewhere and they're not using any recycled stuff. And if there's a demand for it, now I buy recycled paper and it costs a little more, but I figure I'm contributing to the demand for this stuff that eventually will cause less bleaching and all this other stuff from making new paper, less trees.
Well, we can buy recycled paper, but if you want to be the recycler, I mean the, you know, collector of it, and then you can't get rid of it. Because in California, they say they've got a rate of just about 90% on aluminum cans now that are being returned.
Mm-hmm. Well, in Portland, and see, for a long time, the situation was like with people like you. There were only a few diehard recyclers. No businessman was going to retool this factory or build a new factory when they don't have a sure supply of a raw resource. Okay, now what's happening within the last 2 years, things are really changing, you know, and the story about the warehouses full of newsprint, that's going to change, and it is changing. And I know because I've lived in Portland the last year, in Portland, places like Portland and Seattle that have about a 40% participation now in curbside recycling, that has already made a big impact, and they're building new factories.
That policy, though, that has caused it, because mm-hmm. communities are running out of your dump areas and wanting to recycle. But the whole thing of waste is what bothers me. I've been a teacher for many years, and that copy machine, they don't use the back side of it.
Right.
Kids are used to using one side, throw it away. You go to the European country, they write on onion skin, and that's valuable. I mean, real thin paper over here, it's just throw. It's a recycle. It's a throw-away society, they call it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But they can't fix it. They have to throw it away. Mm-hmm. Why can't they put a screw here so they can fix it? But no, you have to throw it away.
Yeah. Well, that is part of the as being a consumer.
Right. Uh-huh.
You buy what you buy right. makes a statement, and then if you can go ahead and write the company and say, you know, I used to buy your product. I used to buy these disposable razors with the plastic handles and buy packs of five. But I decided I'm not going to buy those anymore. And what I would really like to do is find one of those double-edged metal razors that use a new razor blade every once in a while, or whatever.
Does that work?
Yeah, it works. Every time you write a letter, they figure your letter is worth 100 different people had that opinion. But you're the only one that took the time to compose a letter, address an envelope, stamp it, take it to the mailbox.
How is it versus 800 numbers? Are they registered just as much?
I don't know.
It's with your political people. I heard it is sometimes easier just to get your number out and call your senator or whatnot. And it is,
yeah.
Is as effective as a letter can be. I don't know if that's
I don't know. I mean, I don't know on a value, but they're both important. And there's things you can do. Like, I get, catalogs from people that I don't want. And often now those companies have 1-800 numbers. So I just use their 1-800 number to call them up and say, I want to be taken off your mailing list now. Because I don't know how you got my name.
Didn't always take it off?
Oh, yeah.
It takes a while, doesn't it?
No. Well, sometimes you will receive another. And some of the places will say, you may receive two more from us. Please disregard. But I usually don't. That's like their safe limit of saying things. And so, you know, does everyone know about the Direct Mail Association and
yes.
writing them so you don't yeah. get junk mm-hmm. mail?
That, right. It takes a long time to get it stopped.
Yeah, well, what it is your name is already on the list that's being sold around the country. Your name will not be on the next list. What it is an association, so there's a lot of different companies that make money by compiling lists of consumers through, you know, whatever your your target market, you know, I can't think of the word I'm looking for right now, but they estimate that will reduce your junk mail by some 60%. You know, just right off the bat. Now you have to be careful with that, because the next time you order something from a mail order company, if you don't tell them to not let your name out, then you'll get back on the list and you'll start receiving the stuff again. And I haven't figured out yet how to get off the political social justice mailing list, you know. I will get...
Send the stuff back. That's what I've done.
That's what I do, is they will include a self-addressed stamped envelope, you know, one of those, you don't need a stamp. And sometimes I'll send back the whole packet stuffed into that envelope with a note in there saying, I won't be contributing any money to you ever. Please take my name off your list.
Yeah. Well, how are they supposed to solicit? How are they supposed to...
Well, I don't get too down on people that are trying to raise money to feed people, you know. But there's only a certain number of those organizations that I will support. I support quite a few, but what I've been doing also is writing back these people. I got this idea from the Audubon Club. I wrote them. And told them that I'm a member of Audubon, and that I wanted to receive their magazine and their action alert. They come out and they tell you what bills are up in front of Congress and things like that. And I said, I want to receive those two things, and I would like to contribute to you, but I can't all the time. And so they wrote me back and they said, we will only solicit funds from you once a year. And I went, bingo, that's it. And so I started writing all these organizations that I want to belong to and that I care for very much about, you know, Central America groups and hunger in this country and things like that. But I'm writing them and I'm saying, just solicit for me once a year. It's, you know, because some will send you maybe six times a year. Sometimes it seems like every day I get something different. But that's just one thing.
Well, to go back to newspapers, if the government subsidized the recycling of newspapers, would that help?
Oh yeah. If they could provide like a low interest loan for a businessman to build a new factory, are you kidding?
The most important thing the government right now could do to support recycling is to make it mandatory that all the government organizations use recycled paper. Mm. If the government used recycled paper consistently all the time, we would become a recycling society, because nobody uses more paper than the government.
On paper, for example, from gas mileage and all
things. Yeah,
right.
For example.
They could be doing that.
Exactly. I mean, there was a bill, I think it was like a year ago, there was a bill to make, you know, the government recycle. And I was like, yeah, do that. I don't think that they accepted it, but, you know, the idea is brilliant, because instantly, I mean, if all the government bureaucracy, all the, you know, the free mail that the Congress and the representatives get to send out, if all of that and everything from the Environmental Protection Agency to the Department of the Navy, if everything that every person in that whole system wrote on was recycled paper, the whole country would recycle. Right now, they're working on the government is recycling paper, but they don't use recycled yet, as far as I know.
Does everyone understand the recycling loop? That emblem that you see it on paper. There's three arrows in that triangle. And who can tell me what those three arrows represent? Well, you buy recycle. You recycle. And I shouldn't do this to myself.
Somebody has to recycle it.
Well, I guess it's originally you have the product, and then you take it to the collection agency, and then they recycle it when it's turned into a recycled product, and then you buy the recycled product. So to complete the loop, you need to both be buying recycled products and be taking your goods to a recycling center. Or, well, you know, what everyone needs to do is work for your municipality to have curbside recycling, because then everyone will do it. And it's, well, I've had people come talk to me that when one or two people, when you have curbside recycling, and they'll give you a special box to put your things in, or special sacks or whatever, usually boxes, and that's best. But they'll see that a couple people on the street, and then within a week or two, everyone has it, because it's peer pressure.
Yeah.
It's easy to do.
It's really very easy.
But we pay for the privilege of doing it. Mm-hmm. And that's one thing you've got to remember, that comes in
well,
our
see, it's not
and
always
it's
that way. That's
and
the way it is in Seattle, is you pay to have your recycle.
For we pay for
okay.
the privilege of recycling.
Around Chicago last year, some of the suburbs, to get recycling going, what they were doing was they were taking away your recycled goods for free and charging you so much per bag for your other garbage. So people went immediately from families that put out three bags of garbage a week, they put out one bag of garbage and two bags of recycled.
Yeah, see, we get a... we pay less for the amount of garbage, the size garbage can that you choose
mm-hmm.
to use.
Mm-hmm.
You pay less for right. that, but you kind of make up the difference in what...
Right,
up
so it works out about the same.
It works out okay, but
yeah.
you do pay for it.
Yeah, and it ends up... I mean, the reason all this stuff is happening is because the landfills are filling up and
yeah.
it's cost too much for that. I know in Tacoma, it's they're just getting curbside recycling this past year. It's really neat, and I live in an apartment building, so we don't have curbside recycling for an apartment building, but they're getting it.
They're
it's really exciting,
yeah.
you know.
And the downtown businesses, it's slowly creeping in there.
Yeah.
And does everyone understand that the reason it's important to recycle paper is because the figures are that landfills are comprise 37% of paper, and all paper can be recycled except for paper treated to contain moisture, waxed paper. So like our cups from this, you know,
yeah.
downstairs.
Stuff
there,
like carbon paper.
That's going to be buried. But everything else could be recycled. Even, you know, the glossy paper and stuff, what they do is they collect that and they sell it by the ton, and most of it is exported to other countries where they make it into insulation and all kinds of different things.
I think it's interesting looking to this because this has been a topic for 20 years now,
mm-hmm.
and still we are not addressing the issue of life dying. You know, we are. It's interesting. My family now is recycling. You know, not my
mm-hmm.
family, but the surrounding in-laws,
mm-hmm.
because they were forced by their county. They have to put plastic in this bag. But the real key to that whole environment issue is our life dying. How many clothes are we buying? Are we walking instead of driving? You know, it's so
yeah.
easy just to say recycling now, because we're finally
yeah.
right.
But
that's
really when
right.
it comes down to the issue, we haven't changed
yeah.
lifestyle.
Right. The key,
we still use
the
air
key.
Conditioners.
Yeah.
We still...
The key is
that
15 women's clothing, but you can only find one men's clothing just for style.
I like the sheet. I like doing.
Right, it's like the sheet says. The key is not what we put out. It's not where we put it in the recycling bin. It's how much we take in. And like, I moved into my apartment, living on my own, trying to recycle. Got a big bag of paper, which is most of what I've thrown away and stuff. And I've emptied my trash since I moved in there like four times in the last year and a half. I've emptied like four bags of trash this big because I'm trying not to buy plastic, and that's all I'm throwing away.
Yeah.
Recently, a friend of mine, he started a compost pile, which isn't much of a compost pile. It's just a place to put like apple cores. But he started that, and that is the only stuff in my trash that would make me want to throw it away.
Mm-hmm.
I'll throw this away now. And it shocked me because I'm sitting
yeah.
there, you know, filling up this trash thing, and it's just not filling up.
Mm-hmm.
And literally,
yeah.
I have emptied four bags of trash in about a year and a half.
I think the
it's
recycling
really
does make you very conscious of your lifestyle. It has mine. I really try and not buy the stuff. I don't happen to buy soft drinks
yeah.
once in a while, but it does make you conscious of it.
Yeah, especially the plastic, because if you haven't got a box to put it in, it's like, what am I going to do with this?
Yeah.
Well, what you were explaining about how you sort of left out of your family's Christmas celebration because you weren't participating in the gift giving. Now, what would happen to people in general if they became serious about buying less? What happens?
Right. It's like a monkey chasing tail. You lose jobs, factories close down.
No.
Huh? Don't you think one
person? I don't think so. I
30 mile an hour.
I don't think that it would happen fast enough. I don't think so many people would all of a sudden become radical that it would be a negative economic factor. You know? We don't. People are starting to challenge the whole idea that capitalism needs expansion in order to run. You know, there's more, more, more. It's just a simple answer. It's just a simple answer. I don't think that that's the situation. I think that we still, I mean, forever, you know, society was able to function without having the amount of goods that we have. What we have a fabulously wealthy society where about 60% of us live awfully, awfully well. We still have about 20%. We have about 20% or so of our population that does not operate in our society at all like we do. That they just do not participate. They're disenfranchised. They're the poor. And what we do, they still catch the same messages that are being aimed at us to buy, buy, buy. And so what you're having now is teenagers shooting teenagers for their tennis shoes.
That's right.
You know.
A good example is our church where prospects maybe had income terminating or whatever, but we don't have a dishwasher, which I think is great. I mean, we're just a fellowship when you're washing dishes. But the group that wants that dishwasher is because we're causing poisoning and we're going to have flu and just things that germs were spreading around here by washing dishes. So water isn't hot enough. It just goes on and on and on.
Yeah. How did we ever make it this far until we had dishwashers?
I'm advocating we're not going to have a dishwasher. I'm telling you, I have to shut up or I'll be excommunicated.
No, a woman was...
about the paper, the styrofoam cup, too. Wow, did I talk about that in property committee.
Yeah.
Maybe we neglect to point out the good sides about that less is sometimes better. I think in terms of this less, you become much more creative. It's very terrible.
Oh, yes.
And you open up communication, you have different talks with people. It's very rewarding to make your own thing. I don't do everything, but I like sewing and some arts and crafts, and there are so many things. Maybe we like to do to point out the good things, what will come of it.
Well, there's
instead of just the saving business, people, who knows, I don't know.
There's a wonderful book that I recommend to everyone. The Less is More book, written by a Mennonite woman, Doris Jansen Longacre. Do you know this book?
No.
You don't know it?
I read everything in the paper.
She already knows it. She lives it already.
It's across the street in the bookstore. And
I go to the library and read books and I have time, but I have much time to read.
Everyone,
see, I don't buy
go over to the bookstore and ask for the Less is More book. And she just talks about that. You know, in in the Mennonite tradition, you know, in some traditions, they never have felt comfortable in participating fully in our consumer culture. And I would argue that it is a big problem for us, that our consumerism, materialism, I mean, haven't you heard about this preached all our lives, but yet we still participate in it fully. And I mean, I struggle with it all the time, you know, because I've got a compact disc player and I buy these compact discs and they come in these plastic shells. And I mean, I get going, you know, I mean, I want to go shopping and I want to go buy a compact disc. I've got plenty of them to listen to. And I've got ones that I haven't heard in a month, but yet I want more. You know, I found that taking the newspaper for me is like a struggle. You know, because I get all this bad news, and then I find out that there's a sale on something that I want to buy, and all of a sudden, I didn't know that I wanted to buy that until I picked up the newspaper, you know? It's like you can sit down and watch television. You didn't know you were hungry until you saw that picture.